Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And I'm once again joined by my partner in crime, Matthias Nordvig.
Hello, everybody. It's awesome to be back here, at least for a quick spell. This time I have the honor of introducing Professor Howard Williams, archaeologist at the University of Chester in the UK. So welcome to the show.
Hi, both. I'm really honored and excited to be on here. Having watched all of the YouTube versions of your podcast or bits of, you know, obviously, you know, you've been dealing with the lesser known characters like Alexander Ludwig and, you know, that guy from The Last Kingdom. But now you're in the big league with me, obviously. No. It's really exciting. Thank you.
These are the episodes that I get most excited about when it's real, legit scholars. I had the joy of sitting down with Leshek Gedeya. On Tuesday, and like I just love it, especially when it's a topic that I know nothing about. Like, we did Slavic mythology, and I'm just I want to sit here all night and talk.
Yeah, that's really cool. I wish I could have joined you guys for that one. I mean, I love Leshek's work, so that I'm sure that was a great conversation.
He's a good talker as well. Same with you, Howard. That's the thing, where you can get like, and you, Matthias, obviously. I know you looked a little bit sad when I said that then. But you can get scholars sometimes who know their field but aren't always the best talkers when it comes to like an open conversation. And I think it's hard to then get it across. So it's always nice when people have that ability, I guess. Okay, which one of you wants to introduce why we're here? Who wants to take that one?
Howard, you should.
Okay.
Well,
I can give myself a little introduction if you like. In terms of, I'm a specialist in early medieval archaeology, and I've been doing a lot of work, field work, and sort of desk-based work on early medieval Britain and in Scandinavia. But over the years, as a parallel strand, I've been doing a lot of sort of public engagement, both trying to communicate beyond the academy myself, but also trying to critique how we do it. You know, what's the best ways? What are the pitfalls? What are the problems we face as any kind of disciplinary academic, you know, trying to talk beyond our field. And, you know, one of the things with the lockdown, I experimented with YouTube, and that's trundling along very modestly, very humble, doing my Archaeo Death, which is I had a blog from 2013, I should have said. So I did my blog as a sort of public sort of engagement aspect and talking about my research, other people's research. And then I sort of did YouTube for 3 years and a month and a few weeks ago, I started off on there. But they also started off on TikTok as well back in 2020. And so I'm just coming up to the 3 year mark of being on this crazy TikTok app, which is so riddled with issues. But also I'm finding it a really positive medium for interaction. And so over the last 3 years on there, I've addressed a whole range of topics on my specialisms of the archaeology of death, site visits, ancient monuments, landscapes, you know, taking people around with a bit of audio or a bit of commentary, but also doing some responses to other creators who have been saying various points about popular topics. And one of the areas where there's some unpredictable successes I've had in terms of videos that go algorithmically crazy, you know, which I can't even begin to understand why. You know, I literally say two lines to camera about something that I hardly, you know, is way off my topic, and suddenly 100,000 people are viewing it and coming up with all sorts of responses. But one of the areas that I've tried to sort of more seriously engage with is the sort of pop culture views of Vikings, which everyone has. You know, we're all tackling as both an opportunity and a challenge for us, right? You know, it's a really great area for, you know, so much pop culture. There's so much enthusiasm and faith groups. But also simultaneously, there's a lot of, you know, partial information, misinformation, disinformation, and outright hate out there, using this to stoke particular angles, you know, and we all know about these challenges. So I suppose I've been trying as I go along to try and work out a bit of learning as I go about topics I've, you know, I teach to my students in a 2 minute soundbite, you know, and I may say, oh yeah, and of course there's this work on, you know, particular kind of textile, or this work on a particular kind of hairstyle, or a particular kind of brooch, or, and then, but I'm having to, you know, because I'm doing even a 2-3 minute video on TikTok, I do have to do a little bit of extra research to work out where these ideas are coming from. And sometimes it's quite comfy when you're And this is my other point of introduction. Sometimes it's quite easy when you're knocking back an idea that's been around since the 19th century, and there's some obvious candidates here, you know, Vikings as a pure northern people, shall we say. And that idea is still banging around on social media, and we know that that's exploited in particular avenues. But also when I feel I'm up against ideas that are quite new or quite recent and are still coming out of new research, going into the popular domain so fast, as we know, with open access publication, with everyone on social media, podcasts, that it's really difficult to keep up with where particular information is cool and okay, and that's verified and part of ongoing mainstream academia, and when it's fringe or actually quite potentially problematic, not necessarily because it's wrong in itself, but it might lead down a route to other things. And so one of the things I came across was a young person from the North American continent who was saying, we've got archaeological evidence of locked hair traditions, and it's all these guldgooper. They're all locked hair because you can only see five strands of hair, so they must be locks, and spinning off a few other points about it. And I just did a quick response and said, no, you know, great that you do what you want with your hair, but in, as far as I know, we don't have any conclusive evidence of a locked hair tradition. And that was as far as I took it. And then a few other people came back and said, oh, you should look at this Nordic mythology podcast, because they've got a whole discussion of this, and it proves there's a locked hair tradition, and it's the University of Iceland, the whole unit, because people don't really understand these things, the whole of the University of Iceland behind this, and everyone in the Norse pagan community is behind this. And I went, okay. So I did a couple of follow-up videos talking about your podcast, not as a way to be disrespectful. I'm sorry if I did come across that way, but the point was I was responding to a particular dynamic on a particular app to try and make a claim that's far reaching beyond where I thought the evidence was. And I sort of tried to listen through your podcast and work out where they were getting that from. And from an archaeology point of view, I was trying to push back against the idea that there's, you know, literally heaps of archaeological evidence. And the standard cliche with archaeologists, as you know, is we're all denying the truth. We're all hiding the aliens and the ancient civilizations in our back pocket under the pay of various international conspiracies. So, you know, there's this genuine suspicion of academics that we're all hiding the reality. And, so I had lots of comments like that. Yeah, you would say that, you with your glasses and your hair and your jacket in a room with books, you know.
I bet you've got elbow pads, haven't you, as well? Show me those elbows on that jacket.
I deny everything. Yeah. There's no evidence of elbow patches. But you know what I mean. So that's where I came at your podcast, not to come at your podcast, but to make some points about, come on, I didn't feel that quite got the point. And, you know, and so that's where I said those videos. And that was a year ago. And I only refer to it back recently because a whole range of other issues have come up about face paint, tattooing, dental modification issues. And I've been trying to do videos on those. And I was trying to package them and say, look, I've already addressed some of these other issues. And that's where we came into contact. And we've had a sort of email exchange. So I suppose that's where it all came from. And that's to explain to listeners that, you know, I'm not having a go at your podcast. I think it's brilliant that you've got a podcast that's hitting so many different audiences. You've got, you know, creatives, you've got actors, you've got musicians, you've got academics, all here with a common interest. And this is the kind of thing that I fail to do, and most academics fail to do, you know. If I had a hat, hats off to you for all of your efforts on social media, because this is exactly the thing that people just turn their noses up on and say, oh, that's an additional lovely thing you do in your spare time, but we're not going to give you any real support for it. So I'm all behind you and all your efforts on this podcast. I suppose that's my final point to you, is that, you know, I think, you know, we're trying to fight the good fight here, and we're all on the same side, as I think we agree.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I totally agree with that. I think it's great that there are scholars like you out there who will also challenge what we, for instance, say on this podcast. I have said this, I think, a million times on this podcast, that, you know, scholars make mistakes. Yeah, we do. Sometimes we We also end up talking out of turn because the subject of the Viking Age, for instance, is so broad that we're also, you know, we come from different disciplines and we are trying to navigate that to also present decent knowledge to the general public, right? So there are plenty of ways in which we can say something that might end up being interpreted in a problematic way, right? And I would say that that's the case, for instance, with that episode we did on that, right? Because it's not, you know, evidence.
No.
and definitely not evidence of like archaeological material available out there that can tell us that definitely was a tradition that existed. It was a discussion about, well, is that a possibility, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's sometimes also the problem, right, with the way that social media functions, because just because we have that conversation does not mean that we are necessarily pushing a certain idea, and then unfortunately that is how it sometimes is received by the public. And so that's why I also think it's really cool that you what you did in your videos is that, well, the Nordic Mythology Podcast says this and this, and I don't think that's correct, right? Because what you're then doing is that you're also letting the general public know that the scholarly field is having a debate on this, and that the general public should understand that is what it is. It's debates, right? It's not I find it funny that as soon as you then don't cater to the narrative that some people hold on this, then they start attacking you for being an academic, right?
Oh yeah,
that's just straight up bullshit, guys. Like,
and you can't win, can you? Because either if you assert a certainty, then you must be lying, and you can't have any evidence to back it up. And if you say, "Well, I'm not so sure," then they go, "Look, the mask slips." You know, the truth that there's a sliver of doubt about anything in the world of academia. And you can't win with some characters, and you know, you will always, I've been taken out of context, and whether it's on across different media, from YouTube to Twitter to Facebook, which I've kind of given up on, or you know, wherever it may be, it's amazing how these things amplify. And the one thing I found on TikTok I really like and hate is the people are really in fan clubs. They'll say, I mean, I've had this, people try to defend me over things I don't need to be defended over. Oh, you know, you've got to be aware of this. Someone said something about a topic about Viking boat graves. And I said, oh, yeah, whatever. I don't mind. You know, but, you know, people get really sort of, you know, loyal, which is lovely, but also a bit weird. And, you know, it's all part of the fun of discussion. But anyway, yes, I agree with you. But it engages people, I think, and it stokes a bit of outrage. Sometimes can be a good thing, is it can get people thinking and energized and to look into themselves. Because at the end of the day, a lot of the time, what we're trying to do is to get people to actually pick up a book or a Google link, or, you know, and it's hard enough just getting them to do that. So anything that gets them a little bit excited about something can be a good thing. But sometimes, obviously, then it descends into, you know, the slanging matches. And I've had plenty of that on certain other social media apps with certain medievalists, but it's a much more affable environment, actually, I find on at least TikTok. There is anger, but you can usually quickly identify the real problem people, and most people are really quite cool. But the fan club thing is a bit weird.
I think it's fair that we should probably say that, you know, I'm talking to the podcast as a whole, we do present evidence on here from like a lot of scholars from Matthias as well, but also we do have just discussions, and you know, we're talking for an hour and a half sometimes. And we just knock around ideas and theories. And the locked hair one is the idea of whether it could have been possible.
Yes.
And unfortunately, like you said, people, we can't really be responsible of who then takes it after we put it out into the world, and hopefully people listen to it responsibly and understand. But then you do get those people who will then take that and just go, well, this, like you said, this is evidence of. But I can't let you off the hook too quick, okay. though, Howard, because otherwise I would just feel like a massive hypocrite. Because I know, I think the problem with me in the initial video was I felt like you were very quick to, because you did use the word misinformation when it took in terms to like us as a podcast, which was, I don't want to say offensive, but like that is one of the things we started the podcast for, was to try and help combat this idea of how much misinformation there was around these topics. So that was, I think, why Mateus probably got quite, again, not offended, but was like, because I'm just the resident idiot, as I've always said, but Mateus has always been like the scholarly one who, you know, is here to try and keep that integrity. So when that word's thrown around, it's a little hard to not be kind of like, yeah. Oh no, come on. We didn't mean it like that. It's not our fault. Somebody took it. And then I know we're not going to talk about like Josh and his research too much. I think being very quick to like name Josh alongside like misinformation. I was like, because Josh does do his research and he's very due diligent in his talks and his, the information he puts out there. And he was pretty clear that he didn't think that there was a culture of it, but he was just exploring the different avenues, which maybe was lost in your listened through with it, or like the bits that you took.
Okay.
So I do want to just kind of defend that, because I felt like you were a little bit quick to like jump the gun on it. And maybe that's because you only have like a few minutes on TikTok and you kind of just put these things out there. But that was how it came across.
Well, okay. I appreciate that. And I'm sorry that came across that way, but I think I've explained this to Matthias, but I think if you want me to say it, I will say it. Where I thought it constituted misinformation as an episode was because in tackling the early medieval or late Iron Age, you know, evidence strands that we could explore, you know, it was just, it's part of the dynamic of a podcast. And I understand that it's a more of a flow of conversation, but I was trying to make the point in perhaps over detail, unfair detail to Mateus in an email that, you know, we are, you know, by the nature of it, you really spent only about 2 minutes discussing anything that possibly could touch on material or visual evidence, apart from, although Josh does spin back to talk about some visual representations later on. So I think the problem, the misinformation comes from an absence of discussion of the, you know, arguably the only source of evidence that can tell us about what people's beards and hairs actually look like, you know, and so for me, it's not that, you know, you sort of articulated a thesis that was wrong, but I think that by accident, you know, in the flow of conversation, I think it constituted a real yawning gap for me. And this is my archaeological bias, guys, you know, that there wasn't a discussion of that. And so, you know, when I would just come fresh from, you know, having talked with someone with their whole chest on a video showing one, you know, badly drawn gold goober, you know, saying locks, you know, my thought was, oh man, this is why there's that gap. It's not that, you know, they are misinterpreting. It's not your fault that people are taking stuff away. But I think it does speak to a bigger issue, if I may say so, that it's about how we don't always see the gaps until afterwards, until someone else points it out. And I've had this with videos too. And I went, no, that was a categorical video. I'm clearly made my case. And I look back over it and I go, oh no, now I see what they mean. And you have to clarify, and you have to sort of, I end up spending too much time in my comments trying to clarify things I never said, things that I did say that they've misunderstood. And so for me, it sort of ended up, I felt that episode did leave open, there was a dearth of discussion of, you know, the pictorial, the visual and the material data. And I know what Josh was saying about, oh, people just say, but they had combs. And I know why he was so irked by that, because he's probably had that as a sort of dumbass line put in his comments of his whatever social media channel again and again, and he's probably tired of it. But for me, that didn't address, yes, we do have this huge corpus of archaeological evidence. No, it doesn't rule out the possibility of matted and locked hair. Of course it doesn't. But that needs to be balanced. That needs to be there for any popular audience to then actually understand the balance of the data. And so if I may say so, I thought you left a yawning gap there for people to then fill that space. And the problem is, we're doing this all the time as academics, and this is not anything exclusive to your podcast, we're saying one thing and we're not seeing the huge gaps that some people are latching onto. Here's the, then there can't be any, let's fill that with a load of nonsense, this area, because they haven't mentioned it. And so it's not a damning criticism of your podcast or the style of it. It was merely trying to point out that for me, that episode didn't address, mm-hmm. you know, in any substantial way, you know, that evidence. And I think, I don't have it all gathered together to present to you in here, but we could talk about not only the Guld Goober, but various pendants and figurines. There's extensive literature on Baxter metal detecting finds. You know, we can go through all that stuff, and then we can talk about the comb evidence, which goes up through the Viking Age. But anyway, that's what I meant.
Howard, if I may comment, yes. That's again, it comes back also to like the form of social media, yes. Content, right? And one thing that I really want all listeners to always keep in mind is that social media content is never peer reviewed, right? And see, what you did was to peer review on our discussion there, right? And yeah. And that is exactly why we have peer review, so that somebody can come in with qualified knowledge and say, hey, there's a yawning gap in your argumentation right there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then usually if you submit an article to peer review and you get that feedback back, then you remedy that or abandon the project altogether, depending on how detrimental the criticism is, right?
And I know this stuff, Mateus, and I know that Josh knows this stuff. It was not about suggesting you're ignorant or anything, because I have every respect for your learning and your background, and I'm not saying this PhD student doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm saying in that podcast there was a gap. That's all I meant.
Exactly. I think, but this is also what I think is actually needed and quite helpful again when it comes to scholarly presence on social media platforms and the internet in general, that we actually do hold each other accountable in these ways. I wish we had some kind of established network for mitigating that too, so that we could iron such things out in different ways. But a lot of different scholars have also their own agendas for being social media presence, right?
Absolutely.
And as you were pointing out before, we're not getting supported for our presence by any institutions. Mm-hmm. So that means that we are also out there, left out there in the wasteland, fending for ourselves with a stick.
Absolutely. But again, I don't want to, I guess I want to try and put Josh's thoughts forward whilst he's not here. And I can understand from his perspective as to why he would feel upset that maybe, I guess like you've mentioned before about how you have these camps and people jump on the camps, and obviously you have your fans. So then when maybe like you name Josh as an academic alongside like the word misinformation, people then would kind of just attach, oh, Josh Rood, he's just spouting misinformation. And then they just, because people are like that. We alluded to this in the podcast altogether, like people just hear one thing and go, oh, okay, now Josh is just full of shit. And that's, again, that's no part on you, because that's just how people unfortunately react. So I think that's why Josh then responded with his videos.
Fine. I mean, I invite his videos. I watched his videos, and I like his videos. I still don't agree with him, but he has every right to make those responses. And at the end of the day, Josh has done a lot of things that are very brave, if I may say so. You know, he's gone on a podcast. He's got social media whilst doing a doctoral research. That was I didn't do any of that. I was before my time, back in the day, we just had, carrier pigeons to communicate, or ravens, obviously, sorry. seriously though, I think he's doing ongoing research. He's presenting and articulating a complex, multifaceted argument that crosses disciplines. You know, I don't really want to comment on his work anymore. No. And it was a misstep on my part to make it seem that way. And I did a follow-up video that tried to clarify that, and I've opened up the possibility of you know, retracting further if required, because I don't think, you know, I don't want people to see that at all, whether they're a doctoral researcher or the leading professor. And I think I've been accused, you know, the problem is I keep getting, you know, you get accused of everything as an academic all the time. And I do get accused of, if I talk about anybody that's slightly younger than me, I'm punching down. If I criticize someone bigger than me, I'm just, you know, I'm just farming for, you know, outrage against a senior academic and trying to, you know, you can't win. But in this case, I would say that I'm more than happy to disagree with leading scholars, much more leading than me, much more prominent scholars than me. And I've done that in recent videos too, and named them. So I don't want you to think I don't name scholars all the time. And I try to sort of mitigate damage. So it's all good from my point of view, and no real maliciousness intended, but I will.
I don't think that's not what I was meaning either. I don't think for a second there was malicious.
It's not helpful, is it, if I just leave his name hanging. Yeah,
I think it was just a misstep. But anyway, that was all, and I felt like I had to. If I didn't bring it up, I would feel like a little, I don't know, a shill, or just a, is a shill, no. Shill the right word? I don't even know what a fucking shill is. I hear it said all the time, but I would feel like I'm foreign. I would feel like I wasn't doing justice if I didn't at least bring it up. But equally, then this is why I love things like this and having a platform like this where you can say, okay, I don't agree with that episode, and then we can say, okay, well, let's sit down and talk and hear why it's wrong, and you tell us or explain like why you think it's wrong, and then we can have like an open discussion on that. It's kind of the fun in all of this, I think.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, I don't want to comment on Josh's ongoing research, but I think the broader challenge we face, there's a number of areas that I found, you know, this would be no surprise to you guys, but maybe some of the audience need a reminder that some of the things that people get very passionate about the Vikings are things to do with sex, gender and sexuality, masculinity warriors and female warriors, sacrifice and judicial killing, myth and legend, but also hair, appearance, clothing, face paint, tattoos. And, you know, these are zones where, frankly, I could go through my entire career without commenting on the historicity or not of lines on one's chin, you know, and various types of modern aesthetic of face paint that have been promoted. I'm using face paint as an alternative so we don't keep on going about locked hair. But, you know, there's another example of these areas where, frankly, you know, we've got one or two written sources that may speak to that. We don't have mummified, you know, remains that attest one way or the other. We're in this zone where archaeology can make a lot out of one or two helmets or one or two caps or one or two shoes and say, this is what the Vikings wore on their feet based on a handful of objects from two or three sites. Or we say, oh, no, nobody had anything because this is the evidence. And it's the same with combs. You know, it's the challenge of where do we universalize or do we particularize? You know, do we say, well, the Jermundbu helmet from Norway, excavated 1940, whatever, this is what the Vikings all wore on their heads every day. You know, or do we say, this was an exceptional find, most other helmets were probably simpler, you know, da-di-da. Or do we say, no, Vikings never wore helmets, you know. And there's a whole massive spectrum there. And this is the same game we're playing on social media all the time. And some people can't understand this spectrum and this nuance, as Josh was talking about to me, about the need to have nuanced conversations. Because people either want it all to be one, a universal Viking culture with everyone wearing the same beard, same hairstyle, same face paint, same tats, you know. And we know that's ridiculous, but equally, I don't want to be in a position of saying it's there's no evidence of any of this, but it's about trying to, for me, what it's often about is who you're talking to and who needs to hear it as a starting point. And different audiences need to hear different levels. So I have said, you know, statements like we've got absolutely zero evidence of face painting. You know, we've got some evidence of eyeshadow from one account. But, you know, I think this is not this is a modern aesthetic. And then started using that as a baseline to talk about, well, I'm not saying don't wear face paint. Just make sure you're not wearing particular designs that are overtly exploited, taken, appropriated from particular living traditions, so indigenous groups. Do what you want, but just be aware of that and be aware that we don't have that much evidence, but have fun, play, do your cosplay, do your reenactment in whatever face paint you would like to wear or not. But from an archaeologist's point of view, we have to say there's really very little evidence down that route. And I think that's the kind of journey I try to take people on with my videos on TikTok, of start with a statement and then build from that. And it doesn't always go well.
No, so this actually brings me to another related subject, and that is the tendency to romanticize Vikings as sort of the Northern European, Scandinavian, maybe generally European counterpart to like what is called in Scandinavian languages Naturvolk, and German Naturvölker, and translated to English, nature people, right? That's sort of like that the continental term for indigenous groups, right? Yes. And this is a long-standing tradition in Western society. It begins in the 19th century, and it actually has also the tradition itself has a term. It's called Indian Thusianism, or Indian enthusiasm. So essentially, Indian with enthusiasm in it, and this. It starts as these like nature, open air nature plays in Germany, where people are cosplaying Indians and cowboys, right? The offshoot that comes out of that are open air plays with other historical content of various kinds. We get ancient Germanics, we get Vikings. Some of these open air shows actually still take place in Scandinavia today. There are some locations that were built like 100 years ago where they still have these plays once a year in the summertime. Now, the really interesting and bizarre thing around this is that in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s in Germany, this reference to our ancient glorious Germanic past becomes mixed with this idea that they are sort of like these Germanics that, for instance, were victorious in Teutoburger Wald and kicked the colonizing Romans out, right? They correspond to Native Americans. And the Nazis co-opt this whole narrative and actually promote the idea that, oh, we are going to be destroyed in the same way as Native Americans have been destroyed, right? And so, you know, that is a really important backdrop, I would say, to the modern representation, visual representation of the Vikings and Northern Europeans that in one way or another co-opting symbols or the likeness of and aesthetics of indigenous groups today, right? Because it's a straight line from that incredibly toxic and harmful and genocidal argumentation that the Nazis had from that to what we see today in different ways, right? And that's something that I think we should all keep in mind here when we talk about how popular culture represents Scandinavians, and also how Scandinavians themselves choose to represent themselves as closer to nature in different ways. This is something, it's not just face paint on Vikings, it's not just braids or locked hair and so on. It is also the way artists, for instance, just take an example like the Icelandic artist Björk, like promotes an idea of herself and Icelanders closer to nature because of where they live, because of how they exist. I mean, most of them live in a modern city in Reykjavik, and they have like the mountains and ice and all that stuff outside around them, and then sometimes go out into them just like all the tourists. But it's not like they're formed from it. Like, and you get the same thing with Norwegians, you get the same thing with Swedes, you get the same thing with Danes and Finns and so on. So there's a lot to unpack here in terms of narratives surrounding northern populations and then visual representations of their past and also today.
Brilliant. Yes, thank you. And I suppose where I was going with this is that those the various tropes and stylizations that we see, people find it very difficult to see why in itself that is a problem. And I always say it's not. It's about how it feeds into these broader meta narratives of Christian genocide of the we're linked to various trans historical ideas of globalization, which are wrapped onto Charlemagne, and and this is then somehow this I've come across this again and again, and it's not like something dead and gone. It's alive and well on social media. The idea that some people. Not the majority, some people, and it's not exclusive to one faith group either, do want to peddle this idea of, and it has a Christian angle, it has a pagan angle, but it's there as a germ that expresses itself through these things. So I think the problem I also can see is that when some people hear academics talking on these issues, they think we're trying to police modern behaviours. Or they actually, and sometimes when I hear certain academics, that's exactly what they're trying to do. They're basically whiny little, all they're doing is chiding everyone all the time.
You can say it if you want.
I'm not saying anything else, but they're
whiny little bitches. I'll say it.
Their social media feeds are just whiny, complaints about everyone else being wrong. And it's rather hypocritical when it's the academics that are fostered, not just in the 19th and early 20th century, academic communities are fostering these supremacist ideas. So you can't just say, oh, look at all these particular non-academics, they're so stupid, they don't understand that. It's really hypocritical to take that stance, and it becomes almost conspiracy theorist to sort of see every slight use of a rune, every slight use of a face paint as part of some bigger supremacist plot. I've seen that with some academics, and it doesn't help. No. What I am saying, though, is that we have to be aware, we have to be engaged with the historical backdrop. As exactly what Matteo said, it's not that everybody that puts a bit of face paint on or has their hair in a particular style is feeding some kind of beast of supremacist narrative, but it's being aware of that and being competent. If you're on social media, particularly if you're a creator, if you're an academic creator or you're non-academic creator, if you're a makeup artist, you're a loctician or a hairdresser or whatever you are, a musician, you've got to be aware of those audiences. So it's not about policing people's dress, it's about making people aware where this shit comes from and where it's potentially still being taken to, not by those people themselves, but by people that are happy to take that narrative forward. And it's not a myth that we're creating, a fearsome enemy. This is really happening. Every comment section, you see the people rocking up saying, oh, there were no people of color anywhere near Scandinavia in the whole of the first millennium CE. And with all their chest, with all their confidence, and they draw off stuff, and they draw off my work too. And I've had accusations back to me by academics. Your work is being used by these people to say that. And I say, like you said, well, at one level, that's not my responsibility. Another level, what can I do? And then I think, try to think through. And that's one of the reasons I came back on TikTok, is rather than giving up on social media, as I was honestly feeling in 2019, given the way things were going on certain other channels, was to sort of reposition myself and try and explain my work and the work of other colleagues in places where there might be an audience that would listen. And I think that's what, the positive side is that it's not everyone is taking away. For one Egypt, there's 100, 200, 300 people leaving positive comments who get the point, who get the message, like you said, much clearer than I did, Matthias, about that the narratives of indigeneity and how, this is really something we should all just be aware of. And we share a desire to combat that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's so difficult for people when they're living their regular lives and they don't have much time, I guess, to, because I'm very lucky. I get to sit down for an hour and a half every week and speak to some of the most well-informed people on these topics in the world. I'm so lucky, and I still get confused about all these things. Yeah. So when you get somebody who has an interest in Nordic mythology and like a very entry level interest in the Vikings and the Viking Age, and there is so much misinformation out there that outweighs the accurate stuff, yeah, it's so difficult to try and find what's true, what's not true, what comes from nefarious backgrounds, what doesn't. And no matter what you say, somebody has got a counter argument saying, well, that's wrong. It's so complex for people who don't have the time to invest. It's certainly not the time that you two have into your careers, but even like me on my level, like, it's just so difficult with people, and it's such a complex area.
It really is. And, you know, but there's also the, and Howard, you've highlighted that a little bit already, right? And there's the problem with the positions that our academics take themselves, right? You know, you have academics who are very clear on their position and perspective in different ways, so sometimes even their political stance in different ways, and then from there it gets vaguer and vaguer and vaguer, right? And that, you know, one of the things that I am least thrilled about are these academics out there who claim to have no agenda. Because what you get in some cases with that is that, well, first and foremost, if you believe as an academic that you don't have an agenda, then you definitely have an agenda. the problem is that that then you're not aware of where you're at as an academic. Yeah. If that is truly how you believe it, but it's also sometimes a way to cover for an actual agenda that that you're trying to push, and you know you see, for instance, in far right circles to claim this is not an agenda, and then it's definitely
fact, not theory type assertions all the time. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just presenting facts. And it's like, nope, that's not what you're doing right there. that was racist, for instance, or that was misinformation, or that was something else. But it's like, I think it's actually incredibly important too for academics to come out there and say, you know what, I stand for this. That is a particular interpretation of history, because that is what we get. We get interpretations of history. We can try as best as possible to present it on a factual base, right? But we are always, you know, delivering an interpretation, and I'm sure you know that well from your studies of burials, right? I mean, there's so much interpretation that goes into burials, right?
Well, that's where I found myself on the wrong side of a lot of people's expectations of where I would sit with the BJ581 story. And I made myself very unpopular in a range of academic contexts for pointing out some critical points about that scholarship. And I was invited on a very prominent podcast, which went very constructively. But outside of that one podcast, YouTube channel by a certain Dr. Jackson Crawford invited me on, and I think that was a really constructive conversation. But outside of his community and that, I was either completely blanked or, oh, anyone who disagrees with everything about this story must be a misogynist. And wow, okay, fine. But, you know, if that's the way it goes, sometimes I'm going to find myself on different sides of debate. But when I have an expertise, and in this case, my area is burial archaeology, doesn't mean I have an intimate knowledge of every Viking burial. I don't speak all the Scandinavian languages to an intimate knowledge and know all the literature. But I saw an interpretive dissonance there between the narrative and the way it was being presented in the peer-reviewed article, in this case. Mm-hmm. And I sort of called it on my blog, and
just to interrupt, can we which burial are we talking about?
So in 2017 in the American Journal of Physical Anthropology, a reinterpretation was presented based on new genomic evidence from one of the Birka chamber graves, BJ581, the Viking warrior woman. And in 2017 I read that research and thought, that's rather odd as a real, short science article presenting a definitive argument that this is this means that we have at least one high status warrior woman. And I went, hang on a minute, there's some interpretive things here that we should think about. And I presented those, not to disparage the researchers or disparage the DNA evidence, because there were plenty of lunatics online going, if you don't have evidence her head was cut off, she couldn't have been a warrior. And you go, right, okay. You know, there's lots of false reactions to it, shall we say, and they received a lot of abuse and a lot of misogyny for being researchers on that project. So I wasn't intending to foster that. But I just found myself quite critical of the way they'd made their argument in 2017. And so I blogged about it. And I'm just using it as an illustration of the point that where most academics were going, yeah, this really debunks that hyper-masculine Viking perspective. This is something we should celebrate. And there was me being a nerdy, bespectacled, I think not. I think there's a problem here. And yeah. I think people got rather narked off with me for taking that stance rather than going with the flow and sort of accepting the that we should all be really happy. And I was really happy. It was a really good moment for getting education out there about burial archaeology from every period and for Viking research. And it was really positive in many ways, but I also felt there were some issues with the way it was presented. And so, you know, one more point, I suppose, my broader point from that illustration is that sometimes we're going to find ourselves as academics in debates outside of our control, so popular, so controversial, they, you know, we find ourselves being characterized, you know, in ways that are perhaps not fair. But I chose to speak up on that. I could have just shut up and I didn't. So I kind of asked for it. You know, I kind of asked for that attention. But equally,
I think you have to, if it's your area of expertise and you don't think it's right, you have to, even if it goes against the flow and goes against the popular narrative or what people are thinking, you're not doing your job right, in my opinion, if you don't say, okay.
I'd say especially in those like popularized discussions, right? Just like once you see an idea popularized, then
it doesn't make it 100% right.
Hard to get rid of, right? Like horned helmets.
The Vegvisir. The Vegvisir is going nowhere.
No, it's not going to go away.
But in that case, what was really interesting is that when they did a follow-up article in 2019 and addressed the critics, I was not someone deemed to be important enough to be responded to, which is fine. But what was really interesting is that they actually made it worse, in my opinion. And many of my colleagues said, "Oh, well, I did have trouble too, but now I'm okay with the research." And I actually thought it went even worse. And I won't go into the details of that. You can follow up my ArchaeoDeath blog and see what I said. But in the end of the day, if I'm going to be sometimes a critical voice on peer-reviewed research, and I can't, you know, I don't want to talk pick fights all the time, but if it's on my area of expertise and I happen to know about a certain narrow area of field, I feel there's a sort of obligation for me to, you know, say some things about the field and what I feel about it. And it makes you unpopular, but I hope, you know, some people will then say, "Oh, well, that's because of your prejudice." And sometimes it will be, you know, prejudice based on my expertise in certain areas and my lack of knowledge of others. And that's cool. But at the end of the day, you know, I think sometimes there's areas where we have to sort of make our views known, but can I also say this? And I think this is where maybe we are in a different world. I don't talk to the press. No one ever asks me, because I'm not at Oxford, Cambridge or London or York or something. You know, no one comes to me and says, you know, in the press, what do you think of this new story? So all I do is actually reasonably easy to control. And I think you're in a similar position of power in that sense, but in a good way, is that no one, you're not one of these people that, or both of you, you're not asked to proclaim judgment on things like latest piece of research on, you know, somebody at University College London or Oxford University has asked for comment, you know, and I don't get that. And that's good. And I wouldn't like to be in that position, because frankly, I don't want to have to pass comment on every new piece of research. And but I can use my own channels to sort of share some ideas.
To ask me for comment on anything.
I do get asked for comments here and there. The most recent dating of the Scandinavian presence in North America, they actually asked me, I can't remember what, some fancy newspaper on the East Coast sent me an email, "Would you like to comment on that?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure, that sounds plausible." There you go.
There you go.
I mean, okay, well, now I'd actually like to hear a little bit about, and this is something that has always bothered me. I can tell you exactly when it started bothering me.
Okay.
The interpretation of like depictions of the in the archaeological record. You've been mentioning the Gulgubar as an example, right? Yeah. It bothered me back in 2009 when Tom Christensen, the director at the museum in Roskilde, interpreted that little figurine as Odin from Lyra. And
I remember that.
And there's so many problems in interpreting that figure in all kinds of directions. And I think that's such a good case study for looking at problems with interpretations. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that one, as just as an example.
And I haven't got it on the top of my brain, but if I remember rightly, Christiansen came up with the idea it's Odin, and then Ulla Mannering said, hang on, but all the dress is female. And then some people said, then it's definitely Odin, because, and it did feel very much like a version of that Monty Python Life of Brian, where they're going, I'm Brian and so's my wife. It's Odin, it's Odin, who's Odin? Everyone's Odin. And actually, to be fair, back in 2006, in a big edited volume on Old Norse religion, Neil Price did a really good little essay on, about patronizing, but, you know, really good tight little argument about how we attribute every figurine, every human representation of the Viking age has to be labeled. This is definitely Frey, or this is definitely Odin. Yeah. And, you know,
What's in a name? That's article.
That's the one. Yeah. And I think that still holds true. And I wish that had been one of his, you know, open access peer reviewed articles. And I wish he had rewrite it. So maybe he has, but, you know, for a big audience, because that is just a lovely little example of how much inference builds on inference. And almost there's a pressure, you know, everything that's come, a Danish metal detectorist comes up with is it Odin? Is it Odin? And, you know, the latest Bracteate find, which I'm not doubting, it's just another, it's Odin! Well, I mean, frankly, a lot of Bracteate specialists for decades have been talking ad nauseum about everything being Odin from Carl Hauck onward. So this is hardly a sort of revelation. It's a sort of same level of revelation as, you know, shock horror, scientists find evidence the Vikings got to North America before Columbus. It's like, oh, I thought we kind of knew that. You know, it's that level. It's everything is Odin again and again. So about that particular artifact, I have no passionate view other than it's a unique object of a seated figure in high status dress. It could be a king, a queen, a seer, a Volva. It could be Odin as a seer being, it could be any of those things. It could be Frigg, you know, it could be, you know, we could, you know, maybe, just maybe it is a woman for once, you know, that is a female goddess, you know, it's a female goddess, a goddess, you know, but I don't have a passionate view on it. But I think my answer to you is, I think it's a brilliant example, because it bothers me that how we jump to label these finds with absolute certainty, and it's almost 99% Odin.
I agree, and you know, it also sometimes what you find in those arguments that are, you know, some mental gymnastics. I remember, for instance, one of the ways he then later explained the female dress was that, oh no, this is actually just like the Rex Majestis outfit that you would see generally in Europe, where kings would wear actually long dresses going all the way down to the feet. And then there was the chest has like ripples on it, and it's like, oh, that's of course armor. It's like, could it maybe be, I don't know, bead chains that were pretty common in the period?
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of things. So it's like what you see then is that scholars also sometimes like descend upon an idea and then it just has to be that, right?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, well, okay, I had this idea to begin with, but maybe these arguments are actually better, right?
Yeah. Yeah, these are tiny objects. What the other thing people remember is how small a lot of these objects are and the exaggerated features. Why they got such massive eyes? I mean, I haven't seen it yet, and I shouldn't even say it in case it happens. If someone's going to come up with, you know, I can see the TikTok videos by some, with some confident, not always American, but let me do my confident American Hollywood accent, you know. Breaking news, guys! Vikings had huge, bulbous, toad-like eyes. You know, here's the evidence. You know, and then you're going to get another minute and a half of nonsense showing these figurines. You know, the reason is they're tiny and they're stylizing. They've got massive square-headed brooches. Or this is all pre-Viking stuff, isn't it? I'm thinking of the Goldfall figurines, but you know, these are tiny objects. You know, and we're making so much of them. You know, and yeah. I think that's, you know, yeah.
But so, okay, so, but you know, how should we tackle, for instance, written evidence as opposed to the archaeological evidence, especially when we have written evidence and lack thereof in the archaeology, for instance, with tattooing? So we have Ibn Fadlan.
Okay. Yeah.
He describes
the bloody tattooing with you, Matthias.
Yeah. he describes tattooing or tattoos. Seemingly tattoos,
yeah,
on a population that may or may not be Scandinavian, but you know, if you ask me, most certainly is. I would say that whatever else he describes about these people fits quite well with, you know, a lot of other verifiable evidence from Scandinavia. And I also think the only people who have really sort of like been serious about contesting the Scandinavianness of these Rus are Russian scholars, who really don't like the idea that they were Scandinavians. But that aside, he says, oh, these people are tattooed, and then what is of course lacking is is archaeological evidence of that. What do we have from Scandinavia when it comes to tattooing? We have some pins or needles that are from the Danish area, from the Bronze Age, and I think stretching into the Iron Age, that have been interpreted as possible tattooing instruments. But again, that's an interpretation. Okay. Now, there's something really interesting about that in and of itself. I've read a lot on the archaeology of tattooing instruments. And one of the problems that you, for instance, find in North America is that you can see that from a multitude of written records, that the Iroquois, for instance, they were tattooed. But it's really, really difficult to identify their instruments archaeologically.
Yes.
So that's just like one example of how things are problematic. Aside from that, we don't really have any other evidence from Scandinavia from that period.
Everything what you say here matches what I understood. I haven't done extensive research on that topic, but that matches my understanding. And so it depends on who you're talking to and who it matters to. So if you're talking to, you know, about what do we know, that your line is exactly what I've tried to communicate when asked that question on TikTok, for example. I've said, you know, I did a video where I was talking about Scandinavia and my mind was on Scandinavia. I said, there's no evidence of tattooing from the archaeological record. And someone chimed up in the comments, hey, Ibn Fadlan. And I went, okay, I did a second video. I said, yeah, totally forgot about that. Now there's a number of caveats here. You know, are they all, you know, Scandinavian, and, you know, practices will vary, da-di-da. But yeah, it's a compelling possibility. And, you know, that, if we take that as viable, that tells us that below the neck, people were tattooing. And it's only a very small area of discussion where it matters in today's communities. And that relates to very specific choices to tattoo above the neck. And then it becomes an issue. But for most people wanting to tattoo, that's cool. You know, I'm looking at people doing this. But my point is, you know, there's no contestation. There's no problem. I think it becomes an issue when it's a reach to say, we have this one source, therefore everything I do is okay. And it doesn't matter how dodgy the symbol is and how many people in the 1930s were deploying it on certain uniforms. It's okay. You know, and that's not going to affect like 99.9% of modern people selecting tattoos, but it's going to be, they're still there. And that's where I think we have a responsibility, is just to sort of caution to say, you know, I wouldn't never say definitively there's no locked hair at all, or matted hair, or there's no tattooed individuals in Scandinavia. I mean, we've talked again and again through decades how connected the Viking world was, you know, and these boat journeys, while long and difficult and challenging, were relatively easy to hop between major emporia. And, you know, you were exposed to, I'm not saying all of the populations of these big emporia were polyethnic in a modern sense, but they were trading communities. They're bringing slaves and traders from all over. So they were being exposed to all sorts of different practices. But that's not my beef. My beef is only when people try to reach beyond that and therefore try and claim particular motifs, you know, that are taken from, you know, other parts of the world in the contemporary. And that, you know, for 99.9% of people, that doesn't apply. No one would be so crazy as to do that. But there's, you know, it's no one would be so entitled as to do that.
Yeah.
And so that's my only area where I try to be wary of, you know, and try to caution. But no, everything you say would match what the way I would balance it up. You know, archaeology is not going to tell us answers to this unless we find, you know, in a glacier in Norway melting out 100 bodies of, you know, some very stupid Norsemen who froze because they didn't realize it was going to get cold that winter or something, which is, you know, we're getting cool stuff out of glaciers. And I know you've got a recent podcast about that, but my point is, you know, it's not going to, you're not going to get that evidence. It's reaching, putting archaeology on a pedestal to do that. It's trying to expect that somehow we're going to have all the answers to everything people did and want to do.
But what do we then do or say or think about these popular cultural representations where, you know, on the show Vikings, for instance?
Yeah, yeah.
We see all of these badass Vikings with their, you know, modulated mohawks and and face tattoos and so on. What the hell is going on?
Okay. So I have views on the TV show Vikings, and they may surprise you in that I've actually published an article, and I've got three articles on the funerals in the show. And so I've got academic work trying to evaluate the funerals and try to say, okay, this is our modern pop culture Vikings, but what have they done? What have they tried to do here? And I think there are many good lessons with the funeral scenes that I think we can take away. You can see where they're taking bits of Ibn Fadlan's account or the Rus chieftain. We can see where they're taking bits of Danish sites, Swedish sites. They're taking archaeology and they're trying to do something different. And I'm not 100% critical of the TV show in that area, but equally I point out
Lagatha's burial. Fucking hated that.
It's ridiculous.
And I hated that with an absolute passion.
With the massive, all those times they could have used those huge Roman-style massive ballista bolts out of something out of Lord of the Rings, and they could have fired those against the walls of Paris, but they didn't have them then. They kept them back for Lagatha's funeral to break the ice with these huge great arrows. It's like, what the heck?
But it was just there was such a missed opportunity of like the Oseberg ship burial and like this.
Absolutely, this
queen or this female, like, very important figure. Why the fuck didn't they use that? That's what annoyed me. It's like there was such a missed opportunity of this important female figure. You could just buried it and it would have looked so cool, but they just fucking threw her in the sea.
But my point would be, you know, in their defense, that lots of details I would say are just fantasy and ludicrous and, you know, comedic and potentially misleading. But then equally, what they're showing you is that every Viking funeral, they're clearly just making shit up each time. And I think that's a really good lesson. And that does chime with a lot of the work that I do like of Neil Price's and other people who've done work on the variability of my Viking mortuary ritual, is there's no two burials alike. And I think that's one lesson you can take away. So if I was going to defend the Viking TV show on hairstyles, I would say, and costumes, I'd say, yeah, there's loads made up. There's loads taking it way beyond what our evidence allows us. But, you know, it's a TV show. And also I would say they don't show everyone with the same hair, and the individual, the main personalities, their aesthetic evolves. They're constantly there. So I think there are positive lessons to be gained from this, just as you and I would look different depending on whether we can get to the barbers or not, or whether we decide, as you know what I'm going to do. You know, we're seeing characters that are evolving their aesthetic as they change, as their ages, as we see them through their life cycle. And I think that's a really positive thing. So forget some of the details, like Ragnar Lothbrok's tattoos are so bad. I mean,
they are awful.
You know, you think, well, you'd get someone quite artistic, wouldn't you, if you were like a Viking chieftain and king, and, or, you know, surely. But my point is, in their defense, they're not showing like behind him in his army, he doesn't have 1,000 people with exactly the same tats. You know, people seem.
I bet you could make an army of people with that tattoo now, though.
Yes, okay. That's a challenge, isn't it? It's a crowdfunded Comic-Con challenge or something. But no, my point is that I'm not totally disparaging of the show, because while they made lots of aesthetic choices that I think are causing us all trauma on many levels, I think also you could say, with a bit of hindsight and a bit of distance, you could say, you know what that show's done? It's shown that every Viking looked different. Every aristocratic Viking was, you know, carefully preparing their hair, doing differently. Not everyone's got locks. Not everyone's got this. Not everyone's got tats on the side of their face. You know, and in that sense, I think it does show variability, diversity, even to a degree. So please don't think I'm the Howard Williams, defender of the show Viking, says it's all great. But do I think we have to be a bit balanced with our takes on the show? And I think that there are some characters that look, you know, what on earth have they done now? Why is he doing that? It's Yol. Why are they? What? Where's all this red and gold paint on his face from? Well, okay, fine enough. We don't have evidence it didn't happen, but where's it? Why? How? But yes. Then it's, you know. Some bits I thought were quite good.
No, I mean, I have previously also sort of defended Vikings as a TV show for different reasons. One of the things that I'd say, especially in the earlier episodes, is that, I mean, they're kind of treating history in the same way as the Icelandic saga narrators were treating history in the legendary sagas in particular, right? Like, we're beefing up heroes. We are making it more exciting and so on. So I don't think it's all bad. But there is some balance that needs to be reached too, if you ask me. And this is one of the things that I say when I do my consulting and work with people who are, you know, creating some kind of popular product. It could be a book or songs or videos, whatever, about Vikings. And what I usually say to them as one of the first things is that you have to always consider that this might be the entry point for somebody who's interested in the Viking Age or Nordic mythology, that this might be their entry point to that world, right? So you are part of shaping their ideas and beliefs around that period. And so then you have to make conscious choices about, well, how much fiction do I put into it, and how much do I stick to what can only be historically proven, and so on, right? Mm-hmm. Now, and I want to contrast this show, for instance, with Royal Deceit. I don't know if you've seen that movie.
No.
It is from 1994, and it is it's a movie about Prince Amlet of Jutland, as the story is represented in Saxo Grammaticus's History of the Danes, right? And you know what? It's such an interesting and fascinating movie, because the way that I remember the scenes, the dresses, and so on, they have really stuck to only what can be proven historically. So they, like, Christian Bale looks so incredibly boring, in the role of Amleth, right? In sort of like just like a basic tunic. I don't think it's even it doesn't have any color. I think it's just like sort of like gray white-ish, and that's it, right? Contrast that's the story of Amleth, right? Contrast that to the Northmen, which is essentially the same story. It has the same origin, and there what you find is also the use of historical archaeological material in different ways, right? And in very creative ways. Also, it, to me, in some cases, quite believable ways. Like, for instance, Gulgupa down in the pit under the temple, and what goes on down there and all that stuff. I think that's actually quite credible as a way of portraying initiation rituals, or at least parts of initiation rituals. But then you have, you know, a bunch of other things going on in that movie that just goes completely out there. You know, one of the things I love hating on with the movie is like the fight on the volcano.
Oh, what the, Why did they? Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, why did they do that?
Why? There.
I'm with Daniel on this. I felt that way. And well, both of you, I think.
That volcano's hot. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't fire your veg. Fire somewhere fucking normal in the field.
I suppose the baseline for me is, as an educator, where can we take stuff? Whether it's right or wrong, who cares? Where can we create a constructive conversation from it? And where are we feeding dangerous, potentially harmful lines of thinking? And the same product, the same video game, the same movie, the same TV show can potentially, it's not a contradiction to say the same product can do the same, both those things simultaneously. There's constructive conversations, I think, to be had about most of these things, where we can go, okay, and I'd use this in my class. I go, this is what a long ship looks like according to the TV show Viking season 3, and here's a jetty at Kattegat. You know, what do we know about this? Where's the archaeology behind this? And you can usually have a really good conversation with students about that, and they look disappointed that you're saying positive things. And then you say something about the rudder, or you may say something about, well, we don't know if barrels looked exactly like that. But, you know, you can pedantic, you know, that pigeon's wrong, you know, but most of it you can be quite constructive about. And then you hit the things you think, where is this going to go? Could this potentially go? And the problem is we can't future proof. And I think this is one of the takeaway lessons for listeners is that, you know, we can't future proof, but we've got to have conversations about where things are going, because I may be saying something in a piece of published research, peer-reviewed, that I don't know that it's feeding into a particular line of thinking. And that's where communities of scholars and non-academics, because I'm increasingly relying on not my disciplinary specialist, but, you know, historians of religion or anthropologists to remind me of problems or issues with things I just don't have a grasp on. And likewise, reenactors are so valuable to me and Norse pagans and Christian communities too, who can feed in things. Go, you realize that leads, and it's about being able to correct yourself as you go. Both on social media and in our research. And this is why I think, for better or worse, being on these apps and trying to deal with this stuff makes me a better communicator and a better educator, because I'm able to bring some of that stuff back to my students and rethink some of my own preconceived ideas. So, we're all learning all the time, right? You know, and I don't pretend to have done, you know, a whole thesis on locked hair or face tattooing, but we're picking up things and trying to be responsible, but we can't always predict where it's going. And you know, that's, I think, one of the challenges we have. But as communities, we can help to correct each other and sort of help us steer away from some of the more dodgy lines that people are taking things in.
That's also why we need more research on how are things being interpreted, like the reception of history today. We are in dire need of a lot more research on this, actually, in so many different ways, because it is fascinating. I have not seen a lot of research on video games, but I know that is one of the main avenues for my students, for instance. That this is when I start a fall semester with 150 students in a Vikings class, I can tell you it's at least a third, probably more than half, who are in that class because they played some kind of cool Viking video game. And now they're thinking, this is what it's gonna be about. And I'm like, I'm sorry, guys, you're gonna be so disappointed.
Well, I must admit, if you want to, it's open access, so listeners may want to follow this up. But I recently sort of had a public argument in a nice way with one of your Danish colleagues, Professor Soren Sindbeck, who did a paper in Current Swedish Archaeology talking about critiquing two museum exhibitions and criticizing quite heavily. And I agreed with him, but I said, I didn't say it like this. I said it much more politely, but in this sort of, this is in Current Swedish Archaeology latest. My point was, well, come on, Soren, who cares about national museums anymore? This is just a tiny, like, tip of the iceberg of, as you say, Mateusz, video games, TV shows. You know, we
that's
still fixate.
Why
are we writing peer-reviewed keynotes in national journals, agonizing over how a national museum portrays its Viking exhibition? I know it matters, and I'm only being deliberately argumentative. I know it matters what the National Museum in Copenhagen does. I know it matters, but I'm saying, in the grander scheme of what you and I and others are all trying to tackle here, that doesn't make a difference. The real issue is how we deal with these broader pop culture narratives. And that's why I've advocated, and I've got a few publications coming out about this, we need a field called something like Public Viking Research that takes this stuff seriously rather than just another bunch of literary scholars, who I love, of course. I never criticize literary scholars, but agonizing over 19th century receptions of one saga and a detailed analysis of that. We need a more, you know, up-to-date, you know, interdisciplinary field that gives some legitimacy to research projects that want to take on video games, that want to take on TV shows. How does The Last Kingdom compare with this, you know, Vikings and Vikings Valhalla and its representation of people of color? Or, you know, this kind of stuff is really important. And I think that we need sort of, whether you call it, I just used it as a tag phrase, public Viking research, but we can call it whatever we want. But it's talking about our Vikings, the stuff we're all dealing with, the music, the art, you know. And I think that is something that a lot of academics will just see as fluff, you know, just, oh, that's not important. It's just something you do in your spare time. And that attitude is our biggest enemy within the academy. And it's our biggest bane when we're trying to communicate with audiences, if we're just shouting at them when they're wrong, rather than actually taking seriously this pop culture. Sorry, I'm ranting.
It's easier to get it right in the first place than to then try and sweep up everybody and try and correct them after you've already got the wrong opinion.
I totally agree.
I mean, totally agree. That's so fascinating. That's so interesting.
I've never had silence when I've said anything before. That was a special moment for me there. I said something so correct that you had to just take a moment to agree with me. we're nearly an hour and a half in. Okay. I think we should wrap this, because I do want to do like a short Q&A, and I'm going to go do a pub quiz after this, because pub quizzes are fun. But Howard, if you would be up for it, I would love to do an episode with you and Josh together. I know you said you hadn't really looked into it and researched, got all the stuff with you for now, but to go into that, because I think it would be so fascinating for people to listen to, where you can present why you feel that it, or at least the archaeology evidence towards it, and Josh can present his, and not, it doesn't have to be like some big debate thing. It's just like, we can just sit down and chat, because I would love to hear that side of it and hear that evidence, and it feels very fitting to do it with Josh, who also has done so much extensive research on it. It should just be a fun conversation if you would be willing to do that.
Okay, if you think that'd be fine and Josh is up for it, then that'd be great. Yes. Oh,
yeah, he absolutely would be. And I just think it's good for everybody. You know, if we have missed a section, I know we didn't really get into it today, if we've missed an area that you think should have been covered, I think we should then cover it. I don't think we're doing our job right as a podcast if we then don't go, okay, well, there's this little void that we missed, let's cover it. And I think that's kind of our responsibility to do.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that would be fantastic. I think that'd be really constructive. Thank you.
And then we're going to do one on Hogback Stones, because they're my new obsession in life.
Hogback Stones. Where's this obsession coming from? You've got to tell me.
It's your fault.
Oh, it's my
it's your fault. I got into just going out wandering different places around Yorkshire. I just wanted to find all these little things that I didn't know existed, or the people, because there's so much stuff that isn't in museums that's in just little churches dotted around Yorkshire. And I was like, and I couldn't find a comprehensive map of like there everything. So I was just looking around, and then so I was doing research at like midnight and just found these things called Hogback Stones that I'd never heard of before. But every time I searched it, your blog came up with the extensive information you've put out on them. So I just kept going back and reading them and getting deeper into them. So then I went up to Brompton and looked at the ones there. I recently went up, like I said to you, I went up to Durham and looked at those, but they have them guarded. They don't let you film or
touch them, even breathe on them. They're very protective of their hogbacks.
Yeah. they're not as nice as the ones at Brompton. The ones at Brompton, they're lovely.
Yeah.
And the people are so happy to have you go and visit, and they just leave you to go and look at. So that was it. And then I've just been going around the different Sigurd stones and just kind of wandering around Yorkshire with my backpack and my dog. And we've just been looking at cool stuff.
Nice.
Brilliant. Then we should definitely do that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we'd love to do one on that. I think this has been a lot of fun. I think we've covered some good topics. Maybe not been the most historically kind of informational episode, but
we can do those.
Yeah, that's not what we always, you know, we don't always do that. We always cover like new topics, how things affect the modern day. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And I look forward to I definitely look forward to speaking to you again, Howard. And obviously, Matthias, I always look forward to talking with you.
It's always wonderful to be reunited.
It is. Such a bromance. But Howard, just let people know where they can read your blog. Follow you on TikTok.
Okay, Archaeodeath, just put in as a made up word, a neologism I made up just in 2013. Archaeodeath. I thought it sounded a bit metal and a bit silly, but you know, people seem to have it works, doesn't it? So I need to bring out the album now. But no, seriously, I've got a WordPress blog, Archaeodeath. I'm on TikTok as Archaeodeath. I'm on YouTube as Archaeodeath. And can I actually plug a book that people might be able to find of interest? Let me get it for a sec.
Always plug a book.
If people want to know a little bit about the challenges of communicating, I did this edited collection in 2020 called Digging Into the Dark Ages, which you can download for free from the Archaeopress website. And this is edited by myself and my doctoral researcher, Pauline Clark, and it contains chapters addressing the politics and pop culture of things from horned helmets, assembly sites, Chris Tuckley, who has a paper on Jorvik, 40 years of presenting the Vikings in Jorvik. There's papers on museums, and there's interviews with little known people like Dr. Kat Jarman and Dr. Jackson Crawford. So, if that's a sort of trying to evaluate their own practice, you know, why they're doing it, how they're doing it. So if people are interested in how we do public history, public archaeology, Digging Into the Dark Ages. And I've got so much stick for the title. It's not called the Dark Ages. We didn't call it the Dark Ages. That was the point. That was why I called it that. That was part, it's like eye roll. Yes, I know it's not called the Dark Ages, but that's still a popular term. So we have papers on Tintagel in the 5th, 7th to 7th centuries and so on. So yes, that book might be of interest to folks. And you can download it for free, as I said, from the Archaeopress website.
Wonderful.
Sorry for the plug.
No. Don't ever apologize for that. Matthias, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Instagram. Just type in my name, MATHIASNORDVIG. And then you can find my profile there. Sometimes I say stuff or do stuff there. You can also, of course, always go check out my podcast on Spotify or whichever platform you're using for podcasts. It's called The Sacred Flame. I also publish episodes there once in a while. Check out my website, which is just myname.com.
Yeah, definitely go and listen to that. And if you want to watch me wander around Yorkshire with my dog, it's Daniel and Scarfire into One, I guess. And obviously Horns of Odin as well. But yeah, let's jump in and do a little Q&A with the people watching. We'll just do like 15 minutes because I do want to go and do the pub quiz. If you want to watch the Q&As, it's just on Patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast. You get all the Q&As we do on after the show with all the guests. And yeah, there's a bunch of other material on there that you can listen. But Howard, thank you very much. Like I say, I do appreciate you coming on. Obviously, when these things happen, it's always nice to just sit down and talk rather than scream at each other.
No, absolutely. So, thank you so much.
Absolutely appreciate it. Perfect.